This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The old saying, old habits are hard to break, is apparently true, just as it also seems to be true that forming new habits takes a lot of work. There's a reason for that, and Charles Duhigg goes into great detail about it in his book, The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business. Mr. Duhigg is an award-winning business reporter for the New York Times who has taken a close look at some of the science that explains why habits exist, how they can be changed, and why that seems so difficult. And he joins us for the hour. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. He was here last time, folks, to talk about data mining in advance of the election. And some of the things that are found in this book. I just this moment, before we started, read the last page of your book about the author. And it says, Mr. Duhigg can acquire bad habits within minutes. And lives in Brooklyn with his wife and two sons, whose habits include waking at 5 a.m., flinging food at dinner time, and smiling perfectly.
I have to say, they actually woke up at 5 a.m. this morning.
What's up with that?
I was not entirely enthusiastic about that habit.
So, what got you interested in this topic of habits?
Well, it actually started about 9 years ago when I was a reporter in Iraq. This was in 2003, 2004, pretty soon after the U.S. had first gone into Iraq. And I was a new war correspondent. I had never done the job before. And I was looking for stories to tell. And someone told me that I should go talk to this army major down in a city named Kufa, which is about an hour south of Baghdad. This guy had been sent there with the job of stopping riots. If you'll remember, this is the period when riots were happening pretty regularly. So this army major is sent to Kufa with this order, stop the riots. And he sits down with the mayor of the town. And he has a whole laundry list of requests. But the last thing on his list is, can you get all of the food vendors out of the plazas? And the mayor, who's dealing with gun runners and suicide bombers, says, sure, of all the things you've asked me, this is the easiest to do. I'll take all the food vendors out of the plazas throughout the city. So a couple of weeks later, a crowd starts to grow in the plaza next to the Great Mosque of Kufa, which is a very important site in Shia Islam. And what they don't really tell you on TV is that when a riot happens, it actually takes 6 or 7 hours to develop. What happens is that a group of troublemakers shows up, and then spectators and more spectators and more spectators, and so the crowd gets big enough that it kind of tips into a riot. And so this crowd starts developing a couple of weeks after this meeting, and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. The local cops radio the base, so they say, please be on standby. It looks like a riot's about to break out. And then it gets about 5:30 or 6 o'clock at night, which is oftentimes about the time that a riot would start. And the people at the periphery of the crowd, the spectators, start getting hungry, and they look around for something to eat. But all the kebab sellers who are normally in the plaza, they had been all sent home by the mayor. And so the people at the periphery of the crowd who are hungry, they decide to leave so they can go have dinner. And then the people who are sort of one ring in, they see these people walking away and they think to themselves, oh, there must be a better riot going on someplace else. I'm going to follow those guys and see where they're going. And over about 45 minutes, and you can actually see this from the drone footage that was taken overhead, over about 45 minutes, the entire plaza clears out except for the troublemakers. And the troublemakers, who at this point don't have an audience, they just leave too. No riot happens. And in fact, there hadn't been a riot for 9 months since this army major had arrived. And so when I talked to the guy and I said, how did you know that this one small change would influence what the riots happen? What he said was, the military is like this giant habit machine. What they do is they train people to change their habits so that, your natural habit when someone's shooting at you is to shoot back or to run away. They teach you to automatically shoot back. Or when you're overseas and you can email your spouse, you have to have good communication habits. Otherwise, you get into a fight over email and you are distracted when you're on patrol. And he said, once you learn to see the world in terms of a series of habits, it's like someone has given you these glasses and it changes everything. So when I got back to the U.S., I thought, that's fascinating. I want to learn more.
That actually surprised me, given what we talked about last time you were here, and data mining and how certain corporations will study us to the point where they know what we're going to do before we know what we're going to do. I thought that's where this idea came from, but it comes from the military. That's how long have they been applying this and doing so in a way that they know that's what they're doing? They're trying to change habits.
For decades. What's really interesting is that in the last decade, we're living right now through the golden age of understanding habit formation, largely because of advances in our ability to do neurological studies. Much of the precursor research for that was done by the military. I mean, they've known ever since, you know, World War I and World War II, when they were trying to basically get people to shoot more often at the enemy. Mm-hmm. In World War I, they discovered this big problem, which is that most soldiers afterwards said that they had shot at the enemy. But when they went and they looked at actual records, very few soldiers had actually fired upon the enemy. And it was because of these habits, right? Because your habit is if someone is threatening your life, your habit is to duck down. Not to kill someone else. By the Vietnam War, they had changed their entire basic training system so they could get people to fire much more automatically, much more habitually. And then, you know, this is a lot of behavioral training. And then what happens is that in the academy within the last 10 or 15 years, all these advances in understanding how to study the brain begin. And for the first time, we're able to see the neurological roots, the neurological pattern of a habit. And once you know that, you know how to start diagnosing them almost everywhere.
You start your book with the story of a woman named Lisa Allen, who you describe as an unhappy, newly divorced, overweight smoker who had maxed out her credit cards and was unemployed, and she completely turns her life around. Somehow, she was able to reverse a plethora of bad habits, and it was almost like a domino effect. Once she started on one, the next would fall. And she'd also been recruited into this scientific study that took scans of her brain, which you just mentioned. So talk about these neural patterns and what they saw in Lisa Allen, because she's kind of like the holy grail of this kind of research, evidently.
Exactly. And her pattern actually we know happens a lot. So Lisa sort of embodies two things, the first of which is, as you mentioned, the neurology. So what we've learned is that on a neurological level, every habit has three components. There's a cue, which is like a trigger for the automatic behavior to begin. And then a routine, which is the behavior itself. And then finally, a reward. And the reward is how your brain, in particular a part of your brain known as the basal ganglia, learns that pattern and remembers that pattern for the future. Now, for years, when people talked about habits, you know, all the way back to Aristotle, when people talked about habits, they would always focus on the behavior, on the routine. But what we've learned from people like Lisa is that it's really the cues and the rewards that shape how our habits occur and are the leverage points by which to change habits. Now, as you mentioned, what's interesting about Lisa is that she got divorced and she went to Cairo and she sort of had this epiphany. And she basically just decided to quit smoking, right? She came up with this really complicated explanation why. She wanted to trek across the desert, and she was convinced that if she wanted to do it within the next year, and she was convinced that if she was still smoking by then, she would die in the desert, which doesn't make any sense whatsoever. The only way to trek across the Egyptian desert is in a car, and you're like fill it with like water and radios. You can definitely throw in a carton of smokes. There's no problem with that. But she convinces herself she wants to trek across the desert within a year. She has to quit smoking in order to do that. Otherwise, she's going to die. And that quitting smoking became for her what's known as a keystone habit. What we've learned from research is that some habits matter more than others, that when some habits start to change, they set off a chain reaction that seemed to change other habits. For Lisa, quitting smoking was a keystone habit. And within a year, she had transformed, you know, almost every part of her life. She got a good job. She started exercising. She ran a half marathon. She got into a stable relationship. There's something
got out of debt, too.
Got out of debt, exactly. Mm-hmm. There's something about these keystone habits, not only within people's lives, but also within organizations. We know this from studying companies, that when a company can identify a keystone habit and change it, it sets off this chain reaction that seems to multiply the change.
How easy is it to identify these keystone habits, particularly in ourselves? We can talk about business as well, but is it difficult to see them in ourselves? Do others have to point them out? How do we know that's the keystone habit as opposed to just a habit?
Well, researchers who study this have come up with kind of a trick for identifying it. And let me give you as an example exercise, because for a lot of people, exercise is a keystone habit. What studies find is that for some people, when they start exercising regularly, it becomes a habit. They start eating more healthily. And that makes sense, right? Because you're exercising, you feel good about your body, you want to you want to continue feeling good. But what's interesting is that people who start exercising habitually also on average start using their credit cards less. They oftentimes procrastinate less at work. They often do their dishes earlier in the day. Now, those don't make any sense because there's nothing between running in the morning and pulling plastic out of your pocket to charge something. But what's happening there is that there's something about beginning to exercise that changes a person's self-conception, maybe in ways that they don't even realize. And so you go up to the cash register and you have your shopping bag, your shopping basket full of stuff, and you think, oh, there's the Oreos or there's the Splurchis that I usually get. And some part of your brain says, you know, I'm the type of person who can exercise every morning. I have this willpower. I don't need to buy this thing I don't need. And it makes it easier to ignore that purchase. It makes it easier not to overspend on your credit card. And when you talk to researchers and neurologists and psychologists about how to identify these keystone habits, the number one thing that they'll say is people should look for patterns where change seems to scare them, where there's an emotional element. Now, exercise is a great example of this, right? Because if someone was a high school athlete and they've stopped running for a little while and then they start exercising again, it's probably pretty easy for them. There's nothing scary about that. And so for that person, exercise might not be a keystone habit. Hmm. It might not have any sort of secondary effects. But then there's a whole bunch of other people, and I put myself in this category, where when you go to them and you say, okay, I want you to start running tomorrow morning, they'll say, okay. And part of them is kind of terrified. Right? Like I mean, I don't run. I'm going to look like an idiot. Like, I don't even know what route to take. Like, you know, how am I going to feel when I fail at this and I'm in bed and all I want to do is stay in bed? There's something about it that irrationally is kind of scary and emotional. When you find patterns in your life or in your company or in your family that have that small, almost irrational emotional element, that's a clue that it's a keystone habit. That's a clue that when you change that pattern, you will start changing almost subconsciously your self-image in a way that it'll affect all the other patterns in your life.
Is that what sets us apart in all this from Pavlov's dogs? Because as you were talking about the cycles of habits, it sounded to me not unlike the Pavlov experiment with dogs and other animals. But we are self-aware. And so that if we understand that about ourselves, that separates us from that, or does it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what's really interesting, and for folks who don't remember the experiment, Pavlov would basically – he would ring a bell whenever he fed his dogs. And then it got to the point where all he had to do was ring the bell and the dogs would start slobbering uncontrollably, right? Because they had associated the bell, this cue, with this reward of the food. The thing that's interesting about humans and that is fundamentally different is – the dogs could not control whether they slobbered or not. Humans have this amazing ability to decide when something is rewarding or when it's not. And that actually changes our neurological response to that reward. So as an example, you know, I'm sure everyone's been through this experience where you go on a low-carb diet, right? And you love carbs, but you say, I'm going to sign off carbs. And then like a couple of weeks later, you see carbs and all you can think to yourself is, oh, God, they look so gross. I don't want to eat any carbs. Uh-huh. You mentally changed your reaction to that reward. It was purely by dint of kind of thinking about it differently.
I have to take a break. When I come back, I want to talk about some negative rewards that seem to not have an impact on us, because you talk about them in the book. Charles Duhigg is our guest, the author of The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
And you're listening to another archived version of Charlotte Talks here on 90.7 WFAE, listener-supported public radio. Happy New Year, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. You know, you can check out WFAE on Facebook. Just click the like button and you'll get programming updates, links to interesting articles, advance notice of special events, and an occasional peek behind the scenes right here at the station. Stay in touch. Log on to Facebook and search for WFAE. Have you read WFAE's food blog? WFAE Eats covers everything from sustainable food to new happenings in the Charlotte culinary scene. Read more at WFAEats.org. Weather forecast in Charlotte, cloudy today, a high around 52 degrees. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a chance of rain after midnight and a low expected near 38 degrees. For tomorrow, cloudy, rain likely in the afternoon and a high in the mid-50s.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Richard Blanco is the youngest inaugural poet ever. He's also the first immigrant, first Latino, and first openly gay man chosen for the honor. His journey from Cuban immigrant in Miami to inaugural poet for President Obama.
Diane Rehm at 10 on 90.7 FM.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Charles Duhigg, who's an investigative reporter for the New York Times and the author of The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business. We talked about Lisa Allen a few minutes ago, who did some very positive things in her life just by stopping smoking. Everything in her life just kind of dominoed and changed for the positive. But then you write about this woman who, once her kids became old enough to go to school and get out of the house, was bored as a housewife, had nothing to do, and began to gamble just once a week, just to get out of the house for an hour, and it became a runaway problem that bankrupted her husband and her whole family, and she lost her inheritance of $1 million. And when you talk about this habit loop of cue, routine, reward, where's the reward when you sit down at the blackjack table and lose $150,000 in an afternoon?
Well, it's a great question. And her story is just so tragic. And it shows you sort of, particularly when companies know how to take advantage of our habits, how much power they gain over us. The reward for someone like that when you have a gambling dysfunction, a gambling addiction, it's really a habit dysfunction. And the reward oftentimes there is twofold. First of all, there's this kind of flow that people get into when they're gambling, right? You can see it when you look at people playing slots for hour after hour. It's almost as if they forget about time. They enter this moment of pure presentness. It's very similar, according to brain scans, to when people meditate or when people do yoga. But the second thing that happens, and casinos are very good at this, particularly slot machines, there's two types of rewards. There are rewards that are expected rewards. And expected rewards are very important because they train our brain how to develop habits. If I know that eating a cookie makes me feel good, then I'm going to crave more cookies because my brain will learn to associate a cookie with a good feeling. But then there's also intermittent rewards, rewards that are unexpected. And those rewards on a neurological basis are actually more rewarding. If I suddenly give you something that looks like broccoli and you take a bite of it and it tastes like a cookie, you're going to actually enjoy that much, much more than if you ate a cookie, because your brain is completely unprepared for this rush of pleasure. It's not anticipating it at all. It hasn't discounted the experience. And this is what slot machines do. Slot machines give you a steady stream of payouts, not enough that you're going to win. It'll take your money over time, but a steady stream of payouts that you come to expect. That's why you stay at the slot machine.
Yeah, and you write about how the designers of these new modern slots have met with the designers of video games to place these little rewards that make you think you're actually winning when you're not.
Absolutely.
Periodically through the game.
And it's critical. And in fact, the most influential slot machine designer came from the video game world, because what they do is they use all these sounds and these lights and these bells that you don't expect, that come out of nowhere, to give you this reward sensation without actually giving you any money, right?
Yes, you talk about when, like, if you win with three of a kind, when two of a three come up, then bells go off because you've almost got three out of three, and that keeps you going.
Exactly. And what we know from neurological studies is that people who have gambling problems, people who have gambling habit dysfunctions, actually react differently to that near win. So when someone gets a near win, two of a three lining up, and they have a gambling problem, their brain reacts as if they just won. Whereas someone who doesn't have a gambling problem reacts as if they just lost, which is accurate. They did just lose. But the whole point of a casino is to make it feel like you've won even if you haven't. Because once they can trigger those reward sensations, they make it more and more of a habit to keep playing.
I mean, this woman became such a high roller in the eyes of the casino that they kept inviting her back and giving her, she and her family, free weekends and free meals and free rooms. And she would lose money or get it back one weekend and lose more the next weekend until finally they wouldn't extend credit because she had put everything up, including her house. And she lost, and that was the end of it. But they kept – they obviously knew that in her they had – A person with a problem, and yet they still went after her, guilted her into coming for these weekend trips.
That's exactly what she says, and she filed lawsuits to that effect. And now I will say that the casino disputes this. The casino says that they have, and it's a number of casinos. It's owned by a large chain. Mm-hmm. The casino says that they have a program to identify problem gamblers and try and intervene. That being said, we know. And in fact, everyone who works in the casino industry knows there are tens of thousands of problem gamblers, right? People who will gamble away much more than they can really afford. And part of the casino business is built on attracting those people and figuring out the exact right triggers, right? Figuring out how to get them to stay in that seat just an hour longer, how to get them to stay in your casino instead of going to three casinos in Las Vegas. Just stick at one. Once they can figure out your unique habits, the triggers and the rewards that keep you in there, then they can get you to gamble forever.
Are we that transparent, or are people who like to go to casinos, whether they are addicted gamblers or whether they just go recreationally because it's fun for them for the couple of hours that they're there, can they readily, quickly identify the kind of person we are? Do we fall into categories? I guess is the question.
Well. They can identify who we are as long as they have access to our data and a lot of other data to compare us against. So as an example, let's use Target, which isn't a gambling company. Target has a program where they study almost every shopper that they can. And they can, for instance, based on how your shopping habits change, determine if it's likely that you're pregnant, even if you haven't told the store that you're pregnant, or if it's likely that you just got married or got divorced or bought a new house. They can look for these small telltale changes in habits that signal to them there's a life change going on for this person. Now, the only reason they can do that is twofold. Number one, because they have millions and millions of other people to compare you against. And number two, because you actually hand over huge amounts of data whenever you go into a Target. You use your credit card. And they're able to track what you've bought in the past. You use your loyalty card, right? I want my 10% discount. And they know your name and where you live and all the demographic information you gave them. They can buy demographic information, whether you went to college or not, what cars you have at home, whether you are in foreclosure, how much your house is worth. If you take all of that information together, and we live in a time when we create data with almost every action we take, if you take all that data about one individual and you compare it to millions of other people, then I can actually identify your habits pretty quickly and easily. I'm not going to be right all the time. I'm not going to be able to say for certain if I show you this one cue, you're going to gamble a little bit more. Maybe you don't have a gambling problem. Maybe you always gamble for just an hour and it's fine. But I'm going to be right more often than I'm wrong. And at figuring out what your habits are, and that's all that I need to make money.
So let's talk about, because you've mentioned neurological things that go on. Let's talk about what physically is happening in our brains as either habits develop or take hold, or as we try to break them and form new habits. What's physically happening in these brain scans that scientists can see?
Well, so the way our brain works, and our brain is constantly changing, is that We develop neural pathways associated with certain behaviors, right? A cue, a routine, a reward, that develops a neural pathway, which is essentially a pathway that an electrical charge can run down. And as that pathway is used more and more and more, as it's rewarded more and more, it gets thicker and thicker and thicker. And so it's easier for an electrical charge to run down that pathway. That's why a behavior starts to become feel automatic, is because it's the path of least resistance for electrical charges within your brain.
Is that why when you try to do something new, a new task, that you're going to end up doing repeatedly. The first couple of times you do it, it's very difficult, and you have to think about it, and you got to devote a lot of time and attention to it. But then it becomes second nature, like driving a car. You can drive a car and have a conversation, listen to the radio, change your CDs. But if you were 16 and just stepping on the gas pedal for the first time, all of your attention is on the steering wheel and the brake.
That's exactly right. And I'm oversimplifying in part because there's still a lot we don't know about how the brain works. But the act of learning, what you're talking about is really learning, right? Learning how to drive a car. The process of learning from a biophysical perspective is about developing new neural connections. And as that particular behavior happens more and more, and as it has a reward and neurotransmitters sort of attach themselves to that pathway more and more, it gets thicker and thicker. And as it gets thicker, it's easier to do because it's easier for an electrical impulse to run down that particular pathway.
Do these pathways ever go away? For instance, if you spent a good part of your youth learning how to play a guitar and you spent, you know, hours a day trying to copy the guitar licks of Eric Clapton, but you've given it up because you went on and you became an accountant. If you pick up the guitar later in life, those pathways still exist, it would seem to me. You could probably still do a little bit like you could when you were a kid. Is that true?
That's exactly right. So what happens is that once you develop a set of neural pathways, and again, there's a lot about this we don't understand, but once you develop a set of neural pathways, they can get thicker or they can get thinner. So when you extinguish a habit, for instance, in a rat, what happens is that you change all the environment, you take away the cues and the rewards, that neural pathway will get thinner and thinner and thinner, but it will always be there. Once you have a habit, it always exists in your brain. So as a result, the lesson from this is if you learn how to do Eric Clapton licks and you put the guitar down for 30 years and you pick it back up, you'll be a little bit rusty at first. But eventually, you'll begin – those pathways are still there. You'll be able to pick it up much faster than someone who's never learned that before. What that means though is that once you develop a habit, you can never really get rid of it. Now, you can use your willpower to ignore it. You can try and willpower through never doing that behavior. But the best way to – extinguish a habit is to change it, not to simply sort of bulldoze over it. Because we know from a neurological perspective, it's there.
So give me an example of that. I mean, if you wanted to stop, it's easy, it seems to me, for people who smoke to pick up that cigarette after having not smoked for 5 years and suddenly think, yeah, this feels good, and fall back into that old habit.
Absolutely. So the question is, how do you change a habit? What you need to do is you want to look and you want to analyze the cue and the reward and find a new behavior that's linked to the old cue and linked to something similar to the old reward. And here's an example from kind of my life. Before I started working on this book, I had this bad habit where I'd go eat a cookie every afternoon at the New York Times. And I was gaining weight. They have really good cookies at the Times in the cafeteria. I was gaining some weight, and this was kind of an issue for me. And so when I was talking to I would call up these, you know, neurologists, psychologists, and my last question would always be, let's say I have a friend who has a bad cookie habit.
Yeah.
What would you recommend? And their advice was, okay, what you can't do is you can't just extinguish the habit. You can't just say, I'm never going to eat another cookie, because into that vacuum, something you need to place something else. You need to change the habit. And the first step is to identify the cue. So almost all cues fall into one of five categories. It's usually a time of day, a certain place, the presence of certain other people, a particular emotion, or a preceding behavior that has become ritualized. So when I had the cookie urge, I'd write down those five things. You know, who's standing near me? What time is it? And like within 2 or 3 days, it became pretty obvious. The cookie urge always hit me between 3:15 and 3:45. It was clearly a time of day was my cue. And then I had to figure out what the reward was. And I said to the psychologist and neurologist, I said, well, you know, I think the reward is the cookie. Cookies taste really good. And they said, no, you don't understand. Rewards are much more complicated than that. Reward, like a cookie is like 12 different rewards in one little bundle. Because if you're craving, for instance, satisfying hunger, then instead of eating a cookie, you should be able to eat an apple. And so I tried that one day. Or if you're craving the burst of energy, if that's the reward that the sugar gives you, then just have a coffee instead. Or maybe the reward is that it gives you a break from your work, in which case you can just get up and take a walk around the block. So I experimented with all these things. And what I figured out actually within just about a week was the reward for getting a cookie was that when I went up to the cafeteria, I saw 10 or 15 of my colleagues, and I'd sit down and I'd gossip with them for 20 or 30 minutes. I was having this social experience in the cafeteria. The cookie was actually kind of an excuse for the social experience. And once I'd figured out the cue and the reward, I was able to change the habit. Rather than just trying to bulldoze through extinguishing it, I could change it. So now every day at about 3:30, I stand up from my desk. I look around the newsroom. I find someone who's sitting at their desk. I walk over. We gossip for like 20 minutes about whoever happens not to be within earshot. And then I go back to my desk and the cookie urge is totally gone. But the key there was that I changed the habit rather than trying to extinguish it. And study after study after study tells us this is – it's actually kind of known as the golden rule of habit change. You can't just tamp down a habit and ignore it. You have to change the behavior by figuring out what the cue and the reward is and finding something new that delivers something similar.
So those cues could be time, place, people, emotion, or ritualized behavior, or a combination of those things.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And so when you want to create a habit, that's what you should be thinking about is if I want to start running in the morning, I need to give myself as many potential cues as possible. I should always, if possible, try and run the same time every day. I should put my clothes right next – my running clothes next to my bed so I see them when I wake up. I should try and exercise with the same friend each time. I should listen to a workout mix before I get out the door that kind of puts me in this consistent emotional state.
Now, we've been talking about habits as though they are these discrete little things that we do periodically throughout the day or throughout the week. Maybe we only think we have one or two habits. But you say that unless we work on an assembly line, I suppose, most of what we do every day is habitual. And one Duke University researcher claims that more than 40% of the actions we perform every day weren't decisions, they are habits. Really?
Right.
How so?
And when you think about it, this kind of makes sense, right? So this woman, Wendy Wood, followed around hundreds and hundreds of people and basically logged all of their actions. Think about when you back your car out of your driveway. The first couple times, you really had to concentrate on it. But by now, it's so easy that you can just lean over and turn the radio to NPR or talk to your kids or remember that you left Jimmy's lunch on the counter. You can do all this other stuff because backing the car out of the driveway is a habit. Or I'm sure everyone has had that experience where you remember getting in the car and now you're at your desk and you can't remember anything about driving from your home to work.
Exactly.
That's because it's become a habit. Mm. Or when you walk into the cafeteria and you kind of, get the same thing that you get every day. That's
now,
a habit.
Now, having worked in this business for a very long time and having been a program director and having looked at studies that tell people, here's what happens in the morning with people. So you want your morning show to be precisely the same every time. If you do a bit at 8:25 in the morning, that bit better be there every morning at 8:25 because people don't use the clock to tell time. They use you to tell time so that if they don't hear that bit at 8:25, they don't know that they're late. And we know, for instance, that when people get up and do their morning routine, they do exactly the same thing in the same order every morning. They even write down to brushing your teeth exactly the same way. You start on the left side or the right side or the top or the bottom, but it's always the same every single day. How did that happen to us?
It's because our brain actually wants to turn everything it can into a habit. Habits are incredibly energy saving. And so our brain will try and turn anything into a habit, which is great because it means that we can think about other things while we're brushing our teeth.
Charles Duhigg.
But there's obviously downsides.
Yeah, Charles Duhigg is our guest. The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business is his fascinating book about the things that we do and don't even realize that we do every single day. We'll come back with more in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Something I say into this break every day.
And thanks for tuning in this New Year's morning here at 90.7 WFAE, listener-funded public radio. Support this morning for our programming comes from WFAE members and the International Collectibles and Antique Show at Metrolina Expo. Collectors and dealers from antique to shabby chic, tomorrow through Sunday at 7100 Statesville Road. Details at icashows.com. Richard Blanco is the youngest inaugural poet ever. He's also the first immigrant, first Latino, and first openly gay man chosen for the honor. His journey from Cuban immigrant to inaugural poet for President Obama. That's coming up on Diane Rehm at 10 o'clock.
Hi, it's us, Click and Clack from Car Talk. Hey, Tommy, I finally found something worthwhile to do with your old cars.
Really?
And it doesn't involve Boston Harbor and a trunk full of bricks. Get this, donate your old car today, and we'll turn it into Morning Edition Fresh Air and Car Talk tomorrow.
That's fast.
Well, in your case, we need to move quickly before your car turns to dust. Donate now, you'll get a tax deduction, and we'll even tow it away for free.
Call 1-866-789-8627.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Charles Duhigg is the author of The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business, and also an investigative reporter with The New York Times. We've been talking about habit, obviously. We've talked a little bit about how some organizations, from the Army to Target to gambling casinos to others, know about us and our habits and how habits form and what the cues for those habits are and use them for and against us in many ways. I want to play a musical example of this that you talk about in your book. This is a song that we all know, we all have opinions about, and I'll bet you in many cases they're not very positive opinions. But let me play this song.
1, 2, 3. My baby don't mess around because she loves me so, and this I know for sure.
Now, there may be people out there who don't know Hey Ya by Outkast from several years ago, but many of us do, and it's kind of etched somehow into our brains. And that was done in a very deliberate way by Arista Records. Talk about that.
I love this story, I have to say, because I love this song. And when this song first came out, you know, everyone knows this song right now. It was a huge hit. When this song first came out, it was a total bomb. It literally, about 50% of people who heard that song on the radio would change the radio within the first 30, or change the channel within the first 30 seconds after the song came on. And the reason why, you know, Arista was really freaked out about this, radio stations really freaked out. What they figured out is that the reason why is because it just sounded so different from everything else that was on the radio. Right? Is it like a rap song? Is it a rock song? Is it a kind of like classic rock doo-diddy song? When people first heard it, it just sounded so alien. And when it comes to music, what people like is people like things that are familiar. They love to turn on the radio and have the radio expect it play exactly what they expect, or something that sounds very similar to what they expect. A great example of this is Celine Dion. There's been all these studies of how people listen to Celine Dion. And if you ever ask most men, they will say that they hate Celine Dion. And yet, when you put things inside people's cars as they're driving, men do not change the station when Celine Dion comes on. And the reason why is because it sounds exactly like what you expect the radio to sound like. Right? Mm. Every song, Celine Dion song, sounds exactly the same, and it sounds like what you kind of expect. A ballady song is going to come on every 15 minutes on the radio. So the key to programming radio stations is to find enough songs that sound familiar yet are actually new. Maybe a song you've never heard before, but as soon as you hear it, it sounds familiar. And Outkast and Hey Ya was the exact opposite of that. It sounded completely unfamiliar. Mm-hmm. It sounds completely new and different. And so for that song to become a hit, what radio stations had to do is they had to sandwich it. They would take one super, super song that's known as sticky, a song that basically, like a Celine Dion song, or Maroon 5 is another band, a song that even if it's a new song, just sounds exactly like what you expect a radio song to sound like. Mm. And they would put one of them right before Outkast, Hey Ya. And then they would put another super sticky song right after Outkast.
Reward.
And the thought was, right, right, exactly. And the thought was, we can basically trick people into listening to Hey Ya enough times that it will become familiar to them. And it worked. The song was a huge bomb for the first 3 months that it was on the air. By month 6 and 7, it was one of the top-ranked hits because people just got used to it.
Now, is that what TV programmers do on network television with sitcoms that aren't performing terribly well, so they put them in between two other good sitcoms?
Absolutely. Or if you look at, for instance, these shows like NCIS or, you know, CSI.
They're all the same.
I mean, right? They're all the same, right? You don't know. You might not know it because it might be a little bit subconscious, but you know exactly what's going to happen next in those shows. You know, or take House, for instance, a little bit more upbrow. You know that at some point Dr. House is going to hear something and he's going to stare off into the distance and suddenly he's going to solve the problem. One of the reasons why people like shows like that is because they're so familiar. They're so predictable on an almost subconscious level. They tap into these habits that the show has taught us to develop. Now, on the other end are the arty shows, The Sopranos, Breaking Bad. And we love those shows for the exact opposite reason, because they completely upend our habits constantly.
Yes.
They surprise us with every episode.
How do you explain that? That if we want the same thing, if we're in the habit of watching NCIS or Law and Order and all the derivations of Law and Order that have been on the air, because they're exactly the same. And suddenly we run into Breaking Bad, which breaks all of the rules, and the lead character is becoming progressively bad as the show goes on. Why do we like that?
Well, I think that part of it is that first of all, it's worth noting that Breaking Bad has a much smaller audience than Law and Order, right? Mm-hmm. In Breaking Bad, these kind of – even The Sopranos, those shows are seen by many, many fewer people. Mm-hmm. But the other part of it is that think about how you watch those different shows. I never am just flipping through the channels and see a Breaking Bad repeat and just start watching it. Mm-hmm. It's always a destination for me. I set aside Sunday night to go watch that show. Mm-hmm. Whereas Law & Order is the type of thing where it's Thursday, I'm bored, I'll just watch Law & Order. If I come in halfway through the show, it doesn't matter because I can pretty much figure out what happened in the first half. It's a different experience.
But then there are things like Downton Abbey, which has surprised everybody. It surprised the BBC. It has certainly surprised PBS. On Sunday night, the season premiere of season 3 of Downton Abbey beat all of the networks except CBS, which had The Good Wife, with astounding ratings, actually. It was like almost 8 million people watched the thing. Why couldn't they anticipate the success of that show if they know so much about us?
Well, in part, I think it's probably because not to disparage public television, but they don't have the analytics departments that big for-profit corporations have. So, mm-hmm. so they're not looking at the data. They're not collecting data the same way. It's expensive to collect that data, and it's hard to analyze. But the other thing, I think Downton Abbey is a fascinating example of this, because think about if you took out all the accents, if you set Downton Abbey and say – let's say you set it – instead of in England, you set it in Texas. And instead of – during the war, the interwar period, you set it in, say, the 1970s or 1980s. Mm-hmm. You're talking about Dallas, right? you're talking about these soap operas that people used to make fun of. I mean, basically, it's a soap opera with some really nice accents
and
great acting and historical references. And I love soap operas. This is not disparaging soap operas, but I think it actually proves the rule that. That one of the things you love about the shows like Downton Abbey is that they deliver what you kind of expect without admitting to yourself that you expect it. If you go in and you watch Downton Abbey or you watch a movie and it looks like the good guy's not going to win, part of your brain says, you know what? I'll bet you he's going to pull it out by the end. And that's very comforting.
You know, when I was reading through your book, what I found both interesting and rather profound, actually, is that you say that all of these little habits that we have that don't amount to much on their own have enormous impacts on our health, our productivity, financial security, and happiness. If we knew this about ourselves, and we will know this from reading this book, would that give us the impetus, do you think, to make changes for the better?
I think so. And studies back this up. I mean, you're exactly right. The basic lesson from all of this is that it doesn't matter what you have for lunch today, but what you have for lunch every day has enormous impacts on your energy levels, your health, how long you're going to live, how much energy you have to play with your kids. And so these small choices, no one of the choices matters, but all of them together matter a huge amount. And what we know from studies that have looked at this is that by simply explaining to people how their habits work and pointing out to them that these small choices matter in aggregate, people begin changing their behaviors. So this is actually this very transformative insight in psychology. For the last 30 or 40 years, a lot of focus has been spent on helping people make the right big strategic decisions. Where are you going to go to college? Who are you going to marry? What job are you going to take? These are choices that we make once or twice or maybe three times in a life, and they're big and they're fundamental and they change a lot about our lives. And those choices are important. But in the last couple of years with behavioral economics and these other fields of study, what we're also realizing is that we've essentially neglected the other part of that equation, which is that there are small daily decisions that have as profound an impact as those big decisions. And we've essentially sort of ignored these small daily decisions. We've ignored how important they are. We've ignored explaining to people how to understand them and make making those decisions easier. And once you begin explaining to people, look, these decisions matter. What you have for lunch every day matters. And here's a way to figure out how to have the right thing kind of easily because you're making it into a habit. Mm-hmm. We know that their behavior starts to kind of snowball. The changes become much easier. There's a book called Nudge written by two behavioral economists, one of which is Richard Thaler, who's one of the most famous behavioral economists out there. And their whole point is by giving people less choices, by making choices easier, we've actually seen people transform their entire lives. By doing automatic deductions from paychecks for 401ks, we have created a vast Social Security or a vast safety net for people in retirement. And yet nobody ever sat down and said, we need to teach everyone about the importance of retirement. Instead, what they said is, we need to teach them about the importance of just saving a little bit each week.
Hmm. Yes, and doing it so it actually isn't a habit because you have no control over it. Once you've made the decision for the automatic deduction, it just happens. You don't even realize you made that money because it's going directly into that account. It's painless.
You stop thinking about it. And that's actually when a habit works, that's how it works too, right? You don't think at this point about brushing your teeth. Excuse me. You don't make a decision to brush your teeth. You just pick up the toothbrush. You don't make a decision to put on your shoes every morning and start with the left tie the left laces first and the right laces first. Everyone ties their shoes the exact same way every morning.
Yeah.
But you don't think about it. It just happens automatically.
But actually, you write about how we got into the habit of brushing our teeth with Pepsodent. And I remember a lot of the same lines that this guy you write about who came up with this in, the early 1900s, when nobody brushed their teeth ever. I remember some of the slogans that he came up with to make people brush their teeth. They were still in use when I was a kid.
So, it's amazing.
Yeah. And I'll let people read the book for that. An email from Ben. Are we really separate from Pavlov's dogs? It seems so many acts we engage in are performed unconsciously. It also seems that it takes an industry of analysts to trick us into buying things we don't need or an institution like the military to condition us to change. I would assume our first requirement toward change is being conscious of our vulnerability to certain, or is it venerability or vulnerability? I think it's vulnerability to certain habitual paths. So that's essentially what we've been talking about, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And to answer Ben's question, which is a great question, the answer is the nice thing about habits is they're incredibly strong, but also incredibly fragile, right? All you have to do is change the cues and the rewards and the habit can completely fall apart or just be aware of it. Mm. So what I would say is the way that we're different from Pavlov's dogs is that by choosing whether a reward has value or not, it actually changes our neurological response to that reward. If you decide at some point that you're going to get a lot of pride, let's say you get an A on a paper. There's nothing inherently rewarding about getting an A on a paper. Unless you decide getting an A is important, and then you feel the sense of pride, and then it's hugely rewarding. That's the difference between us and Pavlov's dogs. Mm-hmm. We get to choose our rewards. And we know from neurological studies that the impact neurologically of that reward changes when we make a choice. Anyone can identify. Companies identify our habits and they take advantage of them because they're working across millions of people. Mm. The way to shut down their ability to do that is just to recognize what they're doing. Once you're aware of it, the power essentially disappears.
We only have about a minute left, but I have an email from the web. We had a comment on our website from a listener, Joy, who is interested in changing a habit for an 18-year-old young man. I guess it's a young man. Video game addiction. Does Mr. Duhigg have any advice on changing habits in other people, children in particular? It's hard enough to change our own habits. How do we change habits in others?
Video games are some of the most sophisticated reward delivery systems on Earth. That's how they build the video games. To change that habit, you got to find a new something that delivers a similar reward. Figure out, talk to the kid and figure out, what does he get from that? Is it pride? Is it relief from boredom? And find a new behavior that delivers something similar. Don't just say, video games are dumb. You got to do something else. You need a plan that delivers a similar reward and take seriously whatever reward that game is delivering.
At the end of your book, you have a chapter talking about how to use habits to create positive life changes. And you write, if you believe you can change, if you make it a habit, the change becomes real. This is a real power of habit, the insight that your habits are what you choose them to be. That's a little message of hope, isn't it?
Hopefully.
I wish we could talk about Febreze. I found that fascinating because evidently Febreze, it was like the Outkast song, a dud of a product that no one wanted, even though they thought it was going to be a great success, and then they found the key to making it so. But that's why you pick up a copy of the book, The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business, by our guest Charles Duhigg, who is also an investigative reporter for the New York Times. Fascinating book and a fun discussion. Thank you for the hour. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks.